8. Courage. In 380 BC, Plato wrote a dialogue, The Laches, in which Socrates and two Athenian generals seek to answer a seemingly simple question. What is courage? The generals, Laches and Nicias, had gone to Socrates to resolve a dispute between them over whether boys undergoing military training should be taught to fight in armor. Nicias thinks they should. Laches thinks they shouldn't. Well, what's the ultimate purpose of the training? Socrates asks. To instill courage, they decide. So then, what is courage? Courage, Laches responds, is a certain endurance of the soul. Socrates is skeptical. He points out that there are times when the courageous thing to do is not to persevere, but to retreat or even flee. Can there not be foolish endurance? Laches agrees, but tries again. Perhaps courage is wise endurance. This definition seemed more apt, but Socrates questions whether courage is necessarily so tightly joined to wisdom. Don't we admire courage in the pursuit of an unwise cause, he asks? Well, yes, Laches admits. Now Nicias steps in. Courage, he argues, is simply knowledge of what is to be feared or hoped either in war or in anything else. But Socrates finds fault here too, for one can have courage without perfect knowledge of the future. Indeed, one often must. The generals are stumped. The story ends with them coming to no final definition, but the reader comes to a possible one. Courage is strength in the face of knowledge of what is to be feared or hoped. Wisdom is prudent strength. At least two kinds of courage are required in aging and sickness. The first is the courage to confront the reality of mortality, the courage to seek out the truth of what is to be feared and what is to be hoped. Such courage is difficult enough. We have many reasons to shrink from it, but even more daunting is the second kind of courage, the courage to act on the truth we find. The problem is that the wise course is so frequently unclear. For a long while, I thought that this was simply because of uncertainty. When it is hard to know what will happen, it is hard to know what to do. But the challenge, I've come to see, is more fundamental than that. One has to decide whether one's fears or one's hopes are what should matter most. I had returned to Boston from Ohio, and to my work at the hospital when I got a late-night page. Jewel Douglas was back, unable to hold food down again. Her cancer was progressing. She'd made it 3.5 months, longer than I'd thought she'd have, but shorter than she'd expected. For a week, the symptoms had mounted. They started with bloating, became waves of crampy abdominal pain, then nausea, and progressed to vomiting. Her oncologist sent her to the hospital. A scan showed her ovarian cancer had multiplied, grown, and partly obstructed her intestine again. Her abdomen had also filled with fluid, a new problem for her. The deposits of tumor had stuffed up her lymphatic system, which serves as a kind of storm drain for the lubricating fluids that the body's internal linings secrete. When the system is blocked, the fluid has nowhere to go. When that happens above the diaphragm, as it did with Sarah Monopoli's lung cancer, the chest fills up like a ribbed bottle until you have trouble breathing. If the system gets blocked up below the diaphragm, as it did with Douglas, the belly fills up like a rubber ball until you feel as if you will burst. Walking into Douglas's hospital room, I'd never have known she was as sick as she was if I hadn't seen the scan. "Well, look who's here," she said, as if I'd just arrived at a cocktail party. "How are you, doctor?" "I think I'm supposed to ask you that," I said. She smiled brightly and pointed around the room. "This is my husband Arthur, whom you know, and my son Brett." She'd got me grinning. Here it was 11 o'clock at night, she couldn't hold down an ounce of water, and still she had her lipstick on, her silver hair brushed straight, and she was insisting on making introductions. She wasn't oblivious to her predicament, She just hated being a patient and the grimness of it all. I talked to her about what the scan showed. She had no unwillingness to face the facts, but what to do about them was another matter. Like my father's doctors, the oncologist and I had a menu of options. There was a whole range of new chemotherapy regimens that could be tried to shrink the tumor burden. I had a few surgical options for dealing with her situation as well. With surgery, I told her, I wouldn't be able to remove the intestinal blockage, but I might be able to bypass it. I'd either connect an obstructed loop to an unobstructed one, or I'd disconnect the bowel above the blockage and give her an ileostomy, which she'd have to live with. I'd also put in a couple drainage catheters, permanent spigots that could be opened to release the fluids from her blocked-up drainage ducts or intestines when necessary. Surgery risked serious complications, wound breakdown, leakage of bowel into her abdomen, infections, but it offered her the only way she could regain her ability to eat. I also told her that we did not have to do either chemo or surgery. We could provide medications to control her pain and nausea and arrange for hospice at home. The options overwhelmed her. They all sounded terrifying. She didn't know what to do. I realized with shame that I'd reverted to being Dr. Informative. Here are the facts and figures. What do you want to do? So I stepped back and asked the questions I'd asked my father. What were her biggest fears and concerns? What goals were most important to her? What trade-offs was she willing to make, and what ones was she not? Not everyone is able to answer such questions, but she did. She said she wanted to be without pain, nausea, or vomiting. She wanted to eat. Most of all, she wanted to get back on her feet. Her biggest fear was that she wouldn't be able to live life again and enjoy it, that she wouldn't be able to return home and be with the people she loved. As for what trade-offs she was willing to make, what sacrifices she was willing to endure now for the possibility of more time later, not a lot, she said. Her perspective on time was shifting, focusing her on the present and those closest to her. She told me that uppermost in her mind was a wedding that weekend that she was desperate not to miss. Arthur's brother is marrying my best friend, she said. She'd set them up on their first date. Now the wedding was just 2 days away, on Saturday at 1 p.m. It's just the best thing, she said. Her husband was going to be the ring bearer. She was supposed to be a bridesmaid. She was willing to do anything to be there, she said. The direction suddenly became clear. Chemotherapy had only a slim chance of improving her current situation, and it came at a substantial cost to the time she had now. An operation would never let her get to the wedding either, so we made a plan to see if we could get her there. We'd have her come back afterward to decide on the next steps. With a long needle, we tapped a liter of tea-colored fluid from her abdomen, which made her feel at least temporarily better. We gave her medication to control her nausea, and she was able to drink enough liquids to stay hydrated. At 3 o'clock Friday afternoon, we discharged her with instructions to drink nothing thicker than apple juice and return to see me after the wedding. She didn't make it. She came back to the hospital that same night. Just the car ride, with all its swaying and bumps, set her vomiting again. The crampy attacks returned. Things only got worse at home. We agreed surgery was the best course now and scheduled her for it the next day. I would focus on restoring her ability to eat and putting drainage tubes in. Afterward, she could decide if she wanted more chemotherapy or to go on hospice. She was as clear as I've seen anyone be about her goals and what she wanted to do to achieve them. Yet still, she was in doubt. The following morning, she told me to cancel the operation. "I'm afraid," she said. She didn't think she had the courage to go ahead with the procedure. She'd tossed all night thinking about it. She imagined the pain, the tubes, the indignities of the possible ileostomy, and then there were the incomprehensible horrors of the complications she could face. I don't want to take risky chances, she said. As we talked, it became clear that her difficulty wasn't lack of courage to act in the face of risks. Her difficulty was in sorting out how to think about them. Her greatest fear was of suffering, she said. Although we were doing the operation in order to reduce her suffering, couldn't the procedure make it worse rather than better? Yes, I said. It could. Surgery offered her the possibility of being able to eat again and a very good likelihood of controlling her nausea, but it carried substantial risk of giving her only pain without improvement or adding yet new miseries. She had, I estimated for her, a 75% chance I'd make her future better, at least for a little while, and a 25% chance I'd make it worse. So what then was the right thing for her to do? And why was the choice so agonizing? The choice, I realized, was far more complicated than a risk calculation. For how do you weigh relief from nausea and the chances of being able to eat again against the possibilities of pain, of infections, of having to live with stooling into a bag? The brain gives us two ways to evaluate experiences like suffering. There is how we apprehend such experiences in the moment and how we look at them afterward, and the two ways are deeply contradictory. The Nobel Prize-winning researcher Daniel Kahneman illuminated what happens in a series of experiments he recounted in his seminal book, Thinking, Fast and Slow. In one of them, he and University of Toronto physician Donald Redlmeyer studied 287 patients undergoing colonoscopy and kidney stone procedures while awake. The researchers gave the patients a device that let them rate their pain every 60 seconds on a scale of 1, no pain, to 10, intolerable pain, a system that provided a quantifiable measure of their moment-by-moment experience of suffering. At the end, the patients were also asked to rate the total amount of pain they experienced during the procedure. The procedures lasted anywhere from 4 minutes to more than an hour, and the patients typically reported extended periods of low to moderate pain, punctuated by moments of significant pain. A third of the colonoscopy patients and a quarter of the kidney stone patients reported a pain score of 10 at least once during the procedure. Our natural assumption is that the final ratings would represent something like the sum of the moment-by-moment ones. We believe that having a longer duration of pain is worse than a shorter duration, and that having a greater average level of pain is worse than having a lower average level. But this wasn't what the patients reported at all. Their final ratings largely ignored the duration of pain. Instead, the ratings were best predicted by what Kahneman termed the peak-end rule, an average of the pain experienced at just 2 moments, the single worst moment of the procedure and the pain experienced at the very end. The gastroenterologists conducting the procedures rated the level of pain they had inflicted very similarly to their patients, according to the level of pain at the moment of greatest intensity and the level at the end, not according to the total amount. People seemed to have two different selves. An experiencing self who endures every moment equally and a remembering self who gives almost all the weight of judgment afterward to two single points in time, the worst moment and the last one. The remembering self seems to stick to the peak-end rule even when the ending is an anomaly. Just a few minutes without pain at the end of their medical procedure dramatically reduced patients' overall pain ratings, even after they'd experienced more than half an hour of high level of pain. That wasn't so terrible, they'd reported afterward. A bad ending skewed the pain scores upward just as dramatically. Studies in numerous settings have confirmed the peak-end rule and our neglect of duration of suffering. Research has also shown that the phenomenon applies just as readily to the way people rate pleasurable experiences. Everyone knows the experience of watching sports when a team, having performed beautifully for nearly the entire game, blows it in the end. We feel that the ending ruins the whole experience. Yet there's a contradiction at the root of that judgment. The experiencing self had whole hours of pleasure and just a moment of displeasure, but the remembering self sees no pleasure at all. If the remembering self and the experiencing self can come to radically different opinions about the same experience, then the difficult question is which one to listen to. This was Jewel Douglas's torment at bottom, and to a certain extent mine, if I was to help guide her. Should we listen to the remembering, or in this case, anticipating self that focuses on the worst things she might endure? Or should we listen to the experiencing self, which would likely have a lower average amount of suffering in the time to come if she underwent surgery rather than if she just went home and might even get to eat for a while again? In the end, people don't view their life as merely the average of all of its moments, which, after all, is mostly nothing much plus some sleep. For human beings, life is meaningful because it is a story. A story has a sense of a whole, and its arc is determined by the significant moments, the ones where something happens. Measurements of people's minute-by-minute levels of pleasure and pain miss this fundamental aspect of human existence. A seemingly happy life may be empty. A seemingly difficult life may be devoted to a great cause. We have purposes larger than ourselves. Unlike your experiencing self, which is absorbed in the moment, your remembering self is attempting to recognize not only the peaks of joy and valleys of misery, but also how the story works out as a whole. That is profoundly affected by how things ultimately turn out. Why would a football fan let a few flubbed minutes at the end of the game ruin 3 hours of bliss? Because a football game is a story, and in stories, endings matter. Yet we also recognize that the experiencing self should not be ignored. The peak and the ending are not the only things that count. In favoring the moment of intense joy over steady happiness, the remembering self is hardly always wise. An inconsistency is built into the design of our minds, Kahneman observes. We have strong preferences about the duration of our experiences of pain and pleasure. We want pain to be brief and pleasure to last. But our memory has evolved to represent the most intense moment of an episode of pain or pleasure, the peak, and the feelings when the episode was at its end. A memory that neglects duration will not serve our preference for long pleasure and short pains. When our time is limited and we are uncertain about how best to serve our priorities, we are forced to deal with the fact that both the experiencing self and the remembering self matter. We do not want to endure long pain and short pleasure, yet certain pleasures can make enduring suffering worthwhile. The peaks are important, and so is the ending. Jewel Douglas didn't know if she was willing to face the suffering that surgery might inflict on her and feared being left worse off. "I don't want to take risky chances," she said, and by that I realized she meant that she didn't want to take a high-stakes gamble on how her story would turn out. On the one hand, there was so much she still hoped for, however seemingly mundane. That very week, she'd gone to church, driven to the store, made family dinner, watched a television show with Arthur, had her grandson come to her for advice, and made wedding plans with dear friends. If she could be allowed to have even a little of that, if she could be freed from what her tumor was doing to her to enjoy just a few more such experiences with the people she loved, she would be willing to endure a lot. On the other hand, she didn't want to chance a result even worse than the one she already faced with her intestines cinched shut and fluid filling her abdomen like a dripping faucet. It seemed as if there were no way forward. But as we talked that Saturday morning in her hospital room, with her family around her and the operating room standing by downstairs, I came to understand she was telling me everything I needed to know. "We should go to surgery," I told her. but with the directions she'd just spelled out. To do what I could to enable her to return home to her family while not taking risky chances. I'd put in a small laparoscope. I'd look around, and I'd attempt to unblock her intestine only if I saw that I could do it fairly easily. If it looked difficult and risky, then I'd just put in tubes to drain her backed-up pipes. I'd aim to do what might have sounded like a contradiction in terms, a palliative operation, an operation whose overriding priority, whatever the violence and risks inherent, was to do only what was likely to make her feel better immediately. She remained quiet, thinking. Her daughter took her hand. "We should do this, Mom," she said. "Okay," Douglas said. "But no risky chances." "No risky chances," I said. When she was asleep under anesthesia, I made a half-inch incision above her belly button. It let out a gush of thin, blood-tinged fluid. I slipped my gloved finger inside to feel for space to insert the fiber optic scope, but a hard loop of tumor-caked bowel blocked the entry. I wasn't even going to be able to put in a camera. I had the resident take the knife and extend the incision upward until it was large enough to see in directly and get a hand inside. At the bottom of the hole, I saw a free loop of distended bowel. It looked like an overinflated pink inner tube that I thought we might be able to pull up to the skin and make into an ileostomy so she could eat again. But it remained tethered by tumor, and as we tried to chip it free, it became evident that we were risking creating holes we'd never be able to repair. Leakage inside the abdomen would be a calamity. So we stopped. Her aims for us were clear. No risky chances. We shifted focus and put in two long plastic drainage tubes. One we inserted directly into her stomach in order to empty the contents backed up there. The other we laid in the open abdominal cavity to empty the fluid outside her gut. Then we closed up, and we were done. I told her family we weren't able to help her eat again, and when Douglas woke up, I told her as well. Her daughter had tears. Her husband thanked us for trying. Douglas tried to put a brave face on it. "I was never obsessed with food anyway," she said. The tubes relieved her nausea and abdominal pain greatly, 90%, she said. The nurses taught her how to open the gastric tube into a bag when she felt sick and the abdominal tube when her belly felt too tight. We told her she could drink whatever she wanted and even eat soft food for the taste. 3 days after surgery, she went home with hospice to look after her. Before she left, her oncologist and the oncology nurse practitioner saw her. Douglas asked them how long they thought she had. "They both filled up with tears," she told me. It was kind of my answer. A few days after Douglas left the hospital, she and her family allowed me to stop by her home after work. She answered the door herself, wearing a robe because of the tubes and apologizing for it. We sat in her living room, and I asked how she was doing. "She was doing okay," she said. "I think I have a measure that I'm slipping, but she had been seeing old friends and relatives all day, and she loved it. It's my lifeblood, really, so I want to do it." Her family staggered the visits to keep them from tiring her out. She said she didn't like all the contraptions sticking out of her. The tubes were uncomfortable where they poked out of her belly. "I didn't know that there would be this constant pressure," she said. But the first time she found that just opening a tube could take away her nausea, I looked at the tube and said, "Thank you for being there." She was taking just Tylenol for pain. She didn't like narcotics because they made her drowsy and weak, and that interfered with seeing people. I probably confused the hospice people because I said at some point, "I don't want any discomfort. Bring it on," by which she meant the narcotics. But I'm not there yet. Mostly we talked about memories from her life, and they were good ones. She was at peace with God, she said. I left feeling that, at least this once, we'd learned to do it right. Douglas's story was not ending the way she ever envisioned, but it was nonetheless ending with her being able to make the choices that meant the most to her. 2 weeks later, her daughter Susan sent me a note. Mom died on Friday morning. She drifted quietly to sleep and took her last breath. It was very peaceful. My dad was alone by her side with the rest of us in the living room. This was such a perfect ending, and in keeping with the relationship they shared. I am leery of suggesting the idea that endings are controllable. No one ever really has control. Physics and biology and accident ultimately have their way in our lives. But the point is that we are not helpless either. Courage is the strength to recognize both realities. We have room to act, to shape our stories, though as time goes on, it is within narrower and narrower confines. A few conclusions become clear when we understand this, that our most cruel failure in how we treat the sick and the aged is the failure to recognize that they have priorities beyond merely being safe and living longer, that the chance to shape one's story is essential to sustaining meaning in life, that we have the opportunity to refashion our institutions, our culture, and our conversations in ways that transform the possibilities for the last chapters of everyone's lives. Inevitably, the question arises of how far those possibilities should extend at the very end, whether the logic of sustaining people's autonomy and control requires helping them to accelerate their own demise when they wish to. Assisted suicide has become the term of art, though advocates prefer the euphemism death with dignity. We clearly already recognize some form of this right when we allow people to refuse food or water or medications and treatments, even when the momentum of medicine fights against it. We accelerate a person's demise every time we remove someone from an artificial respirator or artificial feeding. After some resistance, cardiologists now accept that patients have the right to have their doctors turn off their pacemaker, the artificial pacing of their heart, if they want it. We also recognize the necessity of allowing doses of narcotics and sedatives that reduce pain and discomfort, even if they may knowingly speed death. All proponents seek is the ability for suffering people to obtain a prescription for the same kind of medications, only this time to let them hasten the timing of their death. We are running up against the difficulty of maintaining a coherent philosophical distinction between giving people the right to stop external or artificial processes that prolong their lives and giving them the right to stop the natural internal processes that do so. At root, the debate is about what mistakes we fear most, the mistake of prolonging suffering or the mistake of shortening valued life. We stop the healthy from committing suicide because we recognize that their psychic suffering is often temporary. We believe that with help, the remembering self will later see matters differently than the experiencing self, and indeed, only a minority of people saved from suicide make a repeated attempt. The vast majority eventually report being glad to be alive. But for the terminally ill, who face suffering that we know will increase, only the stone-hearted can be unsympathetic. All the same, I fear what happens when we expand the terrain of medical practice to include actively assisting people with speeding their death. I am less worried about abuse of these powers than I am about dependence on them. Proponents have crafted the authority to be tightly circumscribed to avoid error and misuse. In places that allow physicians to write lethal prescriptions, countries like the Netherlands, Belgium, and Switzerland, and states like Oregon, Washington, and Vermont, they can do so only for terminally ill adults who face unbearable suffering, who make repeated requests on separate occasions, who are certified not to be acting out of depression or other mental illness, and who have a second physician confirming they meet the criteria. Nonetheless, the larger culture invariably determines how such authority is employed. In the Netherlands, for instance, the system has existed for decades, faced no serious opposition, and significantly grown in use. But the fact that by 2012, 1 in 35 Dutch people sought assisted suicide at their death is not a measure of success. It is a measure of failure. Our ultimate goal, after all, is not a good death, but a good life to the very end. The Dutch have been slower than others to develop palliative care programs that might provide for it. One reason, perhaps, is that their system of assisted death may have reinforced beliefs that reducing suffering and improving lives through other means is not feasible when one becomes debilitated or seriously ill. Certainly, suffering at the end of life is sometimes unavoidable and unbearable, and helping people end their misery may be necessary. Given the opportunity, I would support laws to provide these kinds of prescriptions to people. About half don't even use their prescription. They are reassured just to know they have this control if they need it. But we damage entire societies if we let providing this capability divert us from improving the lives of the ill. Assisted living is far harder than assisted death, but its possibilities are far greater as well. In the throes of suffering, this can be difficult to see. One day, I got a call from the husband of Peg Bockelder, my daughter Hunter's piano teacher. "Peg's in the hospital," Martin said. I'd known she had serious health issues. 2.5 years earlier, she'd developed a right hip pain. The condition was misdiagnosed for almost a year as arthritis. When it got worse, one physician even recommended seeing a psychiatrist and gave her a book on how to let go of your pain. But imaging finally revealed that she had a 5-inch sarcoma, a rare soft tissue cancer eating into her pelvis and causing a large blood clot in her leg. Treatment involved chemotherapy, radiation, and radical surgery, removing a third of her pelvis and reconstructing it with metal. It was a year in hell. She was hospitalized for months with complications. She'd loved cycling, yoga, walking her Shetland sheepdog with her husband, playing music, and teaching her beloved students. She'd had to let go of all of that. Eventually, however, Peg recovered and was able to return to teaching. She needed Canadian crutches, the kind that have a cuff around the forearm, to get around, but otherwise remained her graceful self and refilled her roster of students in no time. She was 62, tall, with big round glasses, a thick bob of auburn hair, and a lovely, gentle way that made her an immensely popular teacher. When my daughter struggled with grasping a sound or technique, Peg was never hurried. She'd have her try this and then try that, and when Hunter finally got it, Peg would burble with genuine delight and hug her close. A year and a half after returning, Peg was found to have a leukemia-like malignancy caused by her radiation treatment. She went back on chemotherapy but somehow kept teaching through it. Every few weeks, she'd have to reschedule Hunter's lesson, and we had to explain the situation to Hunter, who was just 13 at the time. But Peg always found a way to keep going. Then, for 2 straight weeks, she postponed the lessons. That was when I got the call from Martin. He was phoning from the hospital. Peg had been admitted for several days. He put his cell on speaker so she could talk. She sounded weak. There were long pauses when she spoke, but she was clear-voiced about the situation. The leukemia treatment had stopped working a few weeks before, she said. She developed a fever and infection due to her compromised immune system. Imaging also showed her original cancer had come back in her hip and in her liver. The recurrent disease began to cause immobilizing hip pain. When it made her incontinent, that felt like the final straw. She checked into the hospital at that point, and she didn't know what to do. What had the doctors told her they could do? I asked. Not much, she said. She sounded flat, utterly hopeless. They were giving her blood transfusions, pain medications, and steroids for tumor-caused fevers. They'd stopped giving her chemotherapy. I asked her what her understanding of her condition was. She said she knew she was going to die. "There's nothing more they can do," she said, an edge of anger creeping into her voice. I asked her what her goals were, and she didn't have any she could see possible. When I asked what her fears for the future were, she named a litany: facing more pain, suffering the humiliation of losing more of her bodily control, being unable to leave the hospital. She choked up as she spoke. She'd been there for days, just getting worse, and she feared she didn't have many more. I asked her if they'd talked to her about hospice. They had, she said, but she didn't see what it could do to help her. Some in her position offered death with dignity might have taken it as the only chance for control when no other options seemed apparent. Martin and I persuaded Peg to try hospice. It'd at least let her get home, I said, and might help her more than she knew. I explained how hospice's aim, at least in theory, was to give people their best possible day, however they might define it under the circumstances. It seemed like it had been a while since she'd had a good day, I said. Yes, it has. A long while, she said. That seemed worth hoping for, I said. Just one good day. She went home on hospice within 48 hours. We broke the news to Hunter that Peg would not be able to give her lessons anymore, that she was dying. Hunter was struck low. She adored Peg. She wanted to know if she could see her one more time. We had to tell her that we didn't think so. A few days later, we got a surprising call. It was Peg. If Hunter was willing, she said, she'd like to resume teaching her. She'd understand if Hunter didn't want to come. She didn't know how many more lessons she could manage, but she wanted to try. That hospice could make it possible for her to teach again was more than I'd ever imagined, certainly more than she'd imagined. But when her hospice nurse, Deborah, arrived, they began talking about what Peg cared most about in her life, what having the best day possible would really mean to her. Then they worked together to make it happen. At first, her goal was just managing her daily difficulties. The hospice team set up a hospital bed on the first floor so she wouldn't have to navigate the stairs. They put a portable commode at the bedside. They organized help for bathing and getting dressed. They gave her morphine, gabapentin, and oxycodone to control her pain, and methylphenidate proved helpful for combating the stupor they induced. Her anxieties plummeted as the challenges came under control. She raised her sights. She was focused on the main chance, Martin later said. She came to a clear view of how she wanted to live the rest of her days. She was going to be home, and she was going to teach. It took planning and great expertise to make each lesson possible. Deborah helped her learn how to calibrate her medications. Before she would teach, she would take some additional morphine. The trick was to give her enough to be comfortable to teach and not so much that she would be groggy, Martin recalled. Nonetheless, he said, she was more alive running up to a lesson and for the days after. She'd had no children. Her students filled that place for her, and she still had some things she wanted them to know before she went. It was important to her to be able to say her goodbyes to her dear friends, to give her parting advice to her students. She lived 6 full weeks after going on hospice. Hunter had lessons for 4 of them. And then 2 final concerts were played. One featured Peg's former students, accomplished performers from around the country, the other her current students, all children in middle school and high school. Gathered together in her living room, they played Brahms, Dvorak, Chopin, and Beethoven for their adored teacher. Technological society has forgotten what scholars call the dying role and its importance to people as life approaches its end. People want to share memories, pass on wisdoms and keepsakes, settle relationships, establish their legacies, make peace with God, and ensure that those who are left behind will be okay. They want to end their stories on their own terms. This role is, observers argue, among life's most important for both the dying and those left behind. And if it is, the way we deny people this role out of obtuseness and neglect is cause for everlasting shame. Over and over, we in medicine inflict deep gouges at the end of people's lives and then stand oblivious to the harm done. Peg got to fulfill her dying role. She got to do so right up to 3 days before the end, when she fell into delirium and passed in and out of consciousness. My final remembrance of her is from near the end of her last recital. She'd taken Hunter away from the crowd and given her a book of music she wanted her to keep. Then she put her arm around her shoulder. "You're special," she whispered to her. It was something she never wanted Hunter to forget. Eventually, the time came for my father's story to end as well. For all our preparations and all I thought I had learned, we weren't ready for it, though. Ever since he'd gotten on hospice in the early spring, he'd arrived at what seemed like a new, imperfect, but manageable steady state. Between my mother, the various helpers she had arranged, and his own steel will, he'd been able to string together weeks of good days. Each had its sufferings and humiliations, to be sure. He needed daily enemas. He soiled the bed. The pain medications made his head feel fuzzy, foggy, heavy, he said, and he disliked that intensely. He did not want to be sedated. He wanted to be able to see people and communicate. Pain, however, was far worse. If he lightened up on the dose of his medications, he experienced severe headaches and a lancing pain that shot up and down his neck and back. When he was in the grip of it, the pain became his entire world. He tinkered constantly with his doses, trying to find the combination that would let him feel neither pain nor fogginess, feel normal, like the person he'd been before his body began failing him. But no matter what the drug or dose, normal was out of reach. Good enough, however, could be found. Through the spring and early summer, we still had dinner parties at which he'd preside from the head of the table. He made plans for a new building at the college in India. He sent out a dozen emails a day despite the difficulty controlling his weakened hands. He and my mother watched a movie together almost every night and cheered on Novak Djokovic through his 2-week run to victory at Wimbledon. My sister brought home her new boyfriend, whom she felt might be the one. They did, in fact, eventually marry, and my father was bowled over with happiness for her. Each day, he found moments worth living for, and as the weeks stretched into months, it seemed like he could continue this way a long time. In retrospect, there were signs that he couldn't. His weight continued to drop. The doses of pain medication he required were increasing. During the first couple days of August, I received a series of garbled emails. "Dear Atuli, Wohind Liki Sud," began one. The last one said, "Dear Atul, sorry for scrambled let her. I having problems. With love, Dad." On the phone, he spoke more slowly, with long pauses between sentences. He explained that he sometimes felt confused and was having trouble communicating. His emails were not making sense to him, he said, although he thought they did when he first wrote them. His world was closing in. Then on Saturday, August 6th, at 8 a.m., my mother called, frightened. "He's not waking up," she said. He was breathing, but she couldn't rouse him. It was the medication, we thought. The night before, he'd insisted on taking a whole tablet of buprenorphine, a narcotic pill, instead of a half pill like he'd been taking, my mother explained. She'd argued with him, but he'd become angry. He wanted no pain, he said. Now he wasn't waking up. In doctor mode, she noted his pinpoint pupils, a sign of a narcotic overdose. We decided to wait it out and let the medication wear off. 3 hours later, she phoned again. She had called an ambulance, not the hospice agency. "He was turning blue, Atul." She was in the hospital emergency room. "His blood pressure is 50. He's still not waking up. His oxygen is low. The medical staff gave him naloxone, a narcotic reversal agent, and if he had overdosed, that should have woken him. But he remained unresponsive. A stat chest X-ray showed pneumonia in his right lung. They gave him a face mask with 100% oxygen, antibiotics, and fluids. But his oxygen level would not come up above 70%, an unsurvivable level. Now, my mother said, they were asking whether they should intubate him, put him on drips to support his blood pressure, and move him to the ICU. She didn't know what to do. As a person's end draws near, there comes a moment when responsibility shifts to someone else to decide what to do. And we'd mostly prepared for that moment. We'd had the hard conversations. He'd already spelled out how he wanted the end of his story to be written. He wanted no ventilators and no suffering. He wanted to remain home and with the people he loved. But the arrow of events refuses to follow a steady course, and that plays havoc with a surrogate's mind. Only the day before it seemed he might have weeks, even months. Now she was supposed to believe that hours might be a stretch? My mother's heart was breaking, but as we talked, she recognized the pathway we risked heading down, and that the kind of life intensive care would preserve for him was far from the one he wanted. Endings matter, not just for the person, but perhaps even more for the ones left behind. She decided to tell them not to intubate him. I called my sister and caught her as she was about to board her train into work. She was not ready for the news either. "How could it be?" she asked. "Are we certain he can't return to how he was yesterday?" "It seems unlikely," I said. In few families does everyone see such situations the same. I arrived the quickest at the idea that my father was coming to the end, and I worried most about the mistake of prolonging his suffering too long. I saw the opportunity for a peaceful end as a blessing. But to my sister, and even more my mother, it didn't seem certain at all that he was at the end, and the mistake that loomed largest to them was the possibility of failing to preserve his life long enough. We agreed not to let the hospital do anything further to resuscitate him, while hoping against hope that he'd hang on long enough for my sister and me to get there to see him. We both searched for flights as they moved him to a private hospital room. Later that afternoon, my mother called as I sat at an airport departure gate. "He's awake," she said, "over the moon." He'd recognized her. He was sharp enough to even ask what his blood pressure was. I felt abashed for believing that he wouldn't come too. No matter how much one has seen, nature refuses predictability. More than this, though, what I kept thinking was, I'm going to be there. He may even be all right for a while longer. He was alive just 4 more days, as it turned out. When I arrived at his bedside, I found him alert and unhappy about awaking in the hospital. "No one listens to him," he said. He'd awoken in severe pain, but the medical staff wouldn't give him enough medication to stop it, fearing he might lose consciousness again. I asked the nurse to give him the full dose he took at home. She had to get permission from the doctor on call, and still he approved only half. Finally, at 3 a.m., my father had had enough. He began shouting. He demanded that they take out his IVs and let him go home. "Why are you doing nothing?" he yelled. "Why are you letting me suffer?" He'd become incoherent with pain. He called the Cleveland Clinic, 200 miles away, on his cell phone and told a confused doctor on duty to do something. His night nurse finally got permission for a slug of an intravenous narcotic, but he refused it. "It doesn't work," he said. Finally, at 5 a.m., we persuaded him to take the injection, and the pain began to subside. He became calm, but he still wanted to go home. In a hospital built to ensure survival at all costs, and unclear how to do otherwise, he understood his choices would never be his own. We arranged for the medical staff to give him his morning dose of medication, stop his oxygen and his antibiotics for his pneumonia, and let us take him. By mid-morning, he was back in his bed. "I do not want suffering," he repeated when he had me alone. "Whatever happens, will you promise me you won't let me suffer?" "Yes," I said. That was harder to achieve than it would seem. Just urinating, for instance, proved a problem. His paralysis had advanced from just the week before, and one sign was that he became unable to pee. He could still feel when his bladder became full, but could make nothing come out. I helped him to the bathroom and swiveled him onto the seat. Then I waited while he sat there. Half an hour passed. "It'll come," he insisted. He tried not to think about it. He pointed out the toilet seat from Lowe's he'd had installed a couple months before. It was electric, he said. He loved it. It could wash his bottom with a burst of water and dry it. No one had to wipe him. He could take care of himself. "Have you tried it?" he asked. "That would be no," I said. "You ought to," he said, smiling. But still, nothing came out. Then the bladder spasms began. He groaned when they came over him. "You're going to have to catheterize me," he said. The hospice nurse, expecting this moment would come, had brought the supplies and trained my mother. But I'd done it 100 times for my own patients. So I pulled my father up from the seat, got him back to bed, and set about doing it for him. His eyes squeezed shut the entire time. It's not something a person ever thinks they will come to. But I got the catheter in, and the urine flooded out. The relief was oceanic. His greatest struggle remained the pain from his tumor, not because it was difficult to control, but because it was difficult to agree on how much to control it. By the third day, he'd become unarousable again for long periods. The question became whether to keep giving him his regular dose of liquid morphine, which could be put under his tongue where it would absorb into his bloodstream through his mucous membranes. My sister and I thought we should, fearing that he might wake up in pain. My mother thought we shouldn't, fearing the opposite. "Maybe if he had a little pain, he'd wake up," she said, her eyes welling. "He still has so much he can do." Even in his last couple of days, she was not wrong. When he was permitted to rise above the demands of his body, he took the opportunity for small pleasures greedily. He could still enjoy certain foods and ate surprisingly well, asking for chapatis, rice, curried string beans, potatoes, yellow split pea dal, black-eyed pea chutney, and shira, a sweet dish from his youth. He talked to his grandchildren by phone. He sorted photos. He gave instructions about unfinished projects. He had but the tiniest fragments of life left that he could grab, and we were agonizing over them. Could we get him another one? Nonetheless, I remembered my pledge to him and gave him his morphine every 2 hours as planned. My mother anxiously accepted it. For long hours he lay quiet and stock still, except for the rattle of his breathing. He'd have a sharp intake of breath. It sounded like a snore that would shut off suddenly, as if a lid had come down, followed a second later by a long exhale. The air, rushing past the mucoid fluid in his windpipe, sounded like someone shaking pebbles in a hollow tube in his chest. Then there'd be silence for what seemed like forever, before the cycle would start up again. We got used to it. He lay with his hands across his belly, peaceful, serene. We sat by his bedside for long hours, my mother reading the Athens Messenger, drinking tea, and worrying whether my sister and I were getting enough to eat. It was comforting to be there. Late on his penultimate afternoon, he broke out into a soaking sweat. My sister suggested that we change his shirt and wash him. We lifted him forward into a sitting position. He was unconscious, a complete dead weight. We tried getting his shirt over his head. It was awkward work. I tried to remember how nurses do it. Suddenly I realized his eyes were open. "Hi, Dad," I said. He just looked for a while, observing, breathing hard. "Hi," he said. He watched as we cleaned his body with a wet cloth, gave him a new shirt. "Do you have any pain?" "No." He motioned that he wanted to get up. We got him into a wheelchair and took him to a window looking out onto the backyard where there were flowers, trees, sun on a beautiful summer day. I could see that his mind was gradually clearing. Later, we wheeled him to the dinner table. He had some mango, papaya, yogurt, and his medications. He was silent, breathing normally again, thinking. "What are you thinking?" I asked. "I'm thinking how to not prolong the process of dying. This food prolongs the process." My mom didn't like hearing this. "We're happy taking care of you, Ram," she said. "We love you." He shook his head. "It's hard, isn't it?" my sister said. "Yes, it's hard." "If you could sleep through it, is that what you'd prefer?" I asked. "Yes." "You don't want to be awake? Aware of us? With us like this?" my mother asked. He didn't say anything for a moment. We waited. "I don't want to experience this," he said. The suffering my father experienced in his final day was not exactly physical. The medicine did a good job of preventing pain. When he surfaced periodically at the tide of consciousness, he would smile at our voices. But then he'd be fully ashore and realize that it was not over. He'd realize that all the anxieties of enduring that he'd hoped would be gone were still there. The problems with his body, yes, but more difficult for him, the problems with his mind, the confusion, the worries about his unfinished work, about Mom, about how he'd be remembered. He was at peace in sleep, not in wakefulness. And what he wanted for the final lines of his story, now that nature was pressing its limits, was peacefulness. During his final bout of wakefulness, he asked for the grandchildren. They were not there, so I showed him pictures on my iPad. His eyes went wide, and his smile was huge. He looked at every picture in detail. Then he descended back into unconsciousness. His breathing stopped for 20 or 30 seconds at a time. I'd be sure it was over, only to find that his breathing would start again. It went on this way for hours. Finally, around 10 after 6 in the afternoon, while my mother and sister were talking and I was reading a book, I noticed that he'd stopped breathing for longer than before. "I think he stopped," I said. We went to him. My mother took his hand, and we listened, each of us silent. No more breaths came. Epilogue. Being mortal is about the struggle to cope with the constraints of our biology, with the limits set by genes and cells and flesh and bone. Medical science has given us remarkable power to push against these limits, and the potential value of this power was a central reason I became a doctor. But again and again, I have seen the damage we in medicine do when we fail to acknowledge that such power is finite, and always will be. We've been wrong about what our job is in medicine. We think our job is to ensure health and survival, but really, it is larger than that. It is to enable well-being. And well-being is about the reasons one wishes to be alive. Those reasons matter not just at the end of life or when debility comes, but all along the way. Whenever serious sickness or injury strikes and your body or mind breaks down, the vital questions are the same. What is your understanding of the situation and its potential outcomes? What are your fears and what are your hopes? What are the trade-offs you are willing to make and not willing to make? And what is the course of action that best serves this understanding? The field of palliative care emerged over recent decades to bring this kind of thinking to the care of dying patients. And the specialty is advancing, bringing the same approach to other seriously ill patients, whether dying or not. This is cause for encouragement, but it is not cause for celebration. That will be warranted only when all clinicians apply such thinking to every person they touch, no separate specialty required. If to be human is to be limited, then the role of caring professions and institutions, from surgeons to nursing homes, ought to be aiding people in their struggle with those limits. Sometimes we can offer a cure, sometimes only a salve, sometimes not even that. But whatever we can offer, our interventions and the risks and sacrifices they entail are justified only if they serve the larger aims of a person's life. When we forget that, the suffering we inflict can be barbaric. When we remember it, the good we do can be breathtaking. I never expected that among the most meaningful experiences I'd have as a doctor, and really as a human being, would come from helping others deal with what medicine cannot do as well as what it can. But it's proved true, whether with a patient like Jewel Douglas, a friend like Peg Bockelder, or someone I loved as much as my father. My father came to his end never having to sacrifice his loyalties or who he was, and for that I am grateful. He was clear about his wishes even for after his death. He left instructions for my mother, my sister, and me. He wanted us to cremate his body and spread the ashes in three places that were important to him: in Athens, in the village where he'd grown up, and on the Ganges River, which is sacred to all Hindus. According to Hindu mythology, when a person's remains touch the great river, he or she is assured eternal salvation. So for millennia, families have brought the ashes of their loved ones to the Ganges and spread them upon its waters. A few months after my father's death, we therefore followed in those footsteps. We traveled to Varanasi, the ancient city of temples on the banks of the Ganges, which dates back to the 12th century BC. Waking before the sun rose, we walked out onto the ghats, the walls of steep steps lining the banks of the massive river. We'd secured ahead of time the services of a pandit, a holy man, and he guided us onto a small wooden boat with a rower who pulled us out onto the pre-dawn river. The air was crisp and chilly. A shroud of white fog hung over the city's spires and the water. A temple guru sang mantras broadcast over staticky speakers. The sound drifted across the river to the early bathers with their bars of soap, the rows of washermen beating clothes on stone tablets, and a kingfisher sitting on a mooring. We passed riverbank platforms with huge stacks of wood awaiting the dozens of bodies to be cremated that day. When we'd traveled far enough out into the river and the rising sun became visible through the mist, the pandit began to chant and sing. As the oldest male in the family, I was called upon to assist with the rituals required for my father to achieve moksha, liberation from the endless earthly cycle of death and rebirth, to ascend to nirvana. The pandit twisted a ring of twine onto the fourth finger of my right hand. He had me hold the palm-sized brass urn that contained my father's ashes and sprinkle into it herbal medicines, flowers, and morsels of food: a betel nut, rice, currants, rock crystal sugar, turmeric. He then had the other members of the family do the same. We burned incense and wafted the smoke over the ashes. The pandit reached over the bow with a small cup and had me drink three tiny spoons of Ganga water. Then he told me to throw the urn's dusty contents over my right shoulder into the river, followed by the urn itself and its cap. "Don't look," he admonished me in English, and I didn't. It's hard to raise a good Hindu in small-town Ohio, no matter how much my parents tried. I was not much of a believer in the idea of gods controlling people's fates, and did not suppose that anything we were doing was going to offer my father a special place in any afterworld. The Ganges might have been sacred to one of the world's largest religions, but to me, the doctor, it was more notable as one of the world's most polluted rivers, thanks in part to all the incompletely cremated bodies that had been thrown into it. Knowing that I'd have to take those little sips of river water, I had looked up the bacterial counts on a website beforehand and premedicated myself with the appropriate antibiotics. Even so, I developed a Giardia infection, having forgotten to consider the possibility of parasites. Yet I was still intensely moved and grateful to have gotten to do my part. For one, my father had wanted it, and my mother and sister did too. Moreover, although I didn't feel my dad was anywhere in that cup and a half of gray, powdery ash, I felt that we'd connected him to something far bigger than ourselves in this place where people had been performing these rituals for so long. When I was a child, the lessons my father taught me had been about perseverance, never to accept limitations that stood in my way. As an adult, watching him in his final years, I also saw how to come to terms with limits that couldn't simply be wished away. When to shift from pushing against limits to making the best of them is not often readily apparent. But it is clear that there are times when the cost of pushing exceeds its value. Helping my father through the struggle to define that moment was simultaneously among the most painful and most privileged experiences of my life. Part of the way my father handled the limits he faced was by looking at them without illusion. Though his circumstances sometimes got him down, he never pretended they were better than they were. He always understood that life is short and one's place in the world is small, but he also saw himself as a link in a chain of history. Floating on that swollen river, I could not help sensing the hands of the many generations connected across time. In bringing us there, my father had helped us see that he was part of a story going back thousands of years. And so were we. We were lucky to get to hear him tell us his wishes and say his goodbyes. In having a chance to do so, he let us know he was at peace. That let us be at peace too. After spreading my father's ashes, we floated silently for a while, letting the current take us. As the sun burned away the mist, it began warming our bones. Then we gave a signal to the boatman, and he picked up his oars. We headed back toward the shore.
And now, listen to an interview with the author. Hi, this is Robert Van Kolken. I'm a producer with Macmillan Audio, and I'm here with the author of Being Mortal, Atul Gawande, to ask him a few questions about his book. In Being Mortal, you write about how we deal with aging and our mortality as a society. Are you surprised at all that we pay so little attention to aging and the realities of getting old, given that so many of us are heading into that phase of our lives?
I guess I don't consider it surprising. It's felt to be mostly a bad news story. The experience of aging or facing an illness that we cannot fix is one that causes huge anxiety for understandable reasons. The surprising thing to me is that we in medicine have not been so good at having these conversations with people. Because, you know, we as human beings only experience these things once. whereas physicians and nurses and others in medicine see a lot of people and accumulate some experience and perspective for being able to talk and understand, to talk through people's experiences. I think what I learned in the process of really writing the book, talking to lots of people, patients, doctors, is that some people in medicine are a lot better than others at handling these conversations. And they have a lot more experience. And they have certain ways that they go about it and have certain ideas in mind. And those ideas, I think, are really fundamentally transformative for how we practice in medicine, but also how all of us as human beings can think about experience and begin to handle what a good life might be as we age and as we face death.
With luck, all of us will get old. And most of us have interacted with someone who is old or someone who has a serious illness. Do you think we willfully ignore what may end up happening to us because it's too hard for us to imagine?
Well, you know, the first part of that is I'm not sure how much we have contact. You know, we, our neighborhoods don't have multiple generations in the ways that we used to. And we, you know, increasingly sort of segregate off the people who are disabled, elderly. Certainly we, you know, don't see dying often in our lives, or haven't until recently when things have started to change again to bring the dying home. So the, you know, when it comes to that last fifth of our lives, I'm not sure we are really inside it and see as much what the experience of it is once people shift from independence to dependence. Certainly, though, the children of aging parents, that's the dominant way in which we all have this experience. It's especially the daughters of aging parents who are pulled upon in those ancient ties of family and expectation become a real problem in our two-income earner society and our institutions that feel like prisons for the elderly. I think we feel enormously torn about how to do right by our parents. And so that's where we have the experience, and it feels really awful. and for that reason, we don't look forward to it, you know. and we're certainly terrible about planning for it. I think we like to think it's a very American thing, this optimistic view that, you know, we all live forever and we're never going to age. And, you know, but what I find and write about is that there's that as countries modernize, this becomes extremely common everywhere. And as our lives get older also, it becomes really interesting that I get to talk about some of the psychological work of research of people like Laura Carstensen, who really shows how, you know, when you start to feel you're within a few years of the possibility that you might die, that your whole perspective on the world changes. But the reality is that since now the average life expectancy is creeping past 80, we spend the vast majority of our lives never having to contemplate the end in our daily lives at all. You know, you usually don't think about it until you're less than 10 years from the end, unless if you have that process where you get to just get frail and old and die and not have some terrible terminal cancer, you know, like I write about with some of the patients that I describe, or a heart attack out of the blue and those kinds of things. And so in those folks, you have, you know, when we get to live that long sort of slow progression towards the end, you basically can spend your life without thinking about it all. And that's how we do. You know, anything more than 20 years from the end, certainly, any more than 10 years from the end, probably more than 20 years, we just don't think about it. Very different a century ago, more than a century ago, where, you know, in the 1800s, life expectancy was in the mid-40s, death was common, and, you know, you thought about your mortality. It was something that had a presence in your daily life often, and so that makes a shift in things that that's bound not to be there, given what modern life has made possible.
It's interesting to see how people cope with the decision-making that is an inevitable part of aging and of illness. How hard is it for doctors to help patients make end-of-life decisions?
I think it's brutally hard. I'll let people listen to this book. So I won't try to tell a story from it. But I think what I get to explain and describe is that feeling of sitting across a room from somebody who you have to break the bad news that they have a terminal cancer, something I've had to do now many times, and what it feels like to do it badly, what it feels like to do it well, and what the difference is, even in the words you use, the power of the words you use to make that difference. And then see and feel the process. What I hope is that readers and listeners can see and feel the process of walking alongside these patients, trying to help them along the way, walking alongside my friends, my family members, and that it rings with them with their own experiences about, you know, the moments where things seem to go wrong, where people don't seem to understand each other, and the moments where things really begin to go right and extraordinary things can happen.
If you had one piece of advice to give all of us about how we should think of our impending old age, what would it be?
I think so. We understand that that well-being is more than just health and survival and safety in your life. We know that already, but it's okay to insist that that our doctors, our institutions, know that and respect that as well. I think that's the most important thing. And if I saw anything in what happened in the contrast between, you know, some of the patients and family members I describe in the book whose experiences were not so good, and the ones who have a really remarkable experience as they go through aging and dying, that was the fundamental difference. And that there was that recognition, and my God, if the rest of the world didn't recognize it, they found ways to push back and try to make sure they did.
Thanks so much for talking with me.
This is great. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed Being Mortal, a Macmillan audiobook production from Henry Holt & Company. Text copyright 2014 by Atul Gawande. Production copyright 2014 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.